there is no manufacturing that isn't advanced that has survived in this country. And I think the kind of reshoring that we're going to see is going to be the same.
Hi, I'm Jim Doyle, president of Business Forward, and you're listening to the Business Forward podcast. Business Forward helps local business leaders fix Washington by bringing Washington to them. Subscribe to our podcast to hear conversations with policy experts, elected officials, and business leaders about important issues like climate action and affordable health care.
In this episode, White House Associate Director of Public Engagement, Will McEntee, joined us for introductory remarks on how the Biden administration's American Jobs Plan will impact the Heartland. After these remarks, Mayor Nan Whaley of Dayton, Ohio, moderated a discussion between CEO of Heartland Forward, Ross Duvall, and CEO of Heath, Newark, Licking County Port Authority, Rick Platt, on manufacturing in the Heartland, answering questions from business leaders on entrepreneurship, reshoring jobs, and how climate concerns affect electric vehicle suppliers in the manufacturing sector overall. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Mayor Whaley, Ross, Will, and Rick, thank you for joining us today. Will, we'll open up the briefing with you.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Liz, and thank you to everyone for having me and allowing us this opportunity to share with you, some of the work that we've been doing at the White House. I'm Will McEntee, the Associate Director of Public Engagement at the White House, and manage the role in agriculture portfolio as part of my portfolio at the White House. So, honored to have this opportunity to talk with you about some of the work that we're doing as we engage rural communities through some of the president's early actions and how some of those pieces have related to manufacturing and small businesses as well in rural communities. So I guess I'll start off by talking a little bit about the American Rescue Plan that was signed into law about 3 weeks ago by President Biden, really because, you know, as we all know, COVID-19 has really exacerbated a lot of the issues that face rural communities, whether it's, you know, access to broadband or just, you know, investments in rural communities, rural health facilities. So many things that we know, you know, for years have been underfunded and have required, you know, more resources that, you know, I think we're really seeing, you know, now on the ground how important those resources are. And, so the president signed into law the American Rescue Plan that, you know, both provides, you know, direct economic relief to Americans through the stimulus checks, through the child tax credit, through so many other items in the bill that help to support working families, as well as small businesses and small business owners, but also to tackle COVID-19 to ensure that we have the resources to mount this hurdle, because we all know that to really, you know, move forward on so many of these other goals that the president outlined during his campaign and now early in his administration, that really is the first big hurdle. And so we've been using some of the resources that were passed by Congress to provide for additional support for vaccine distribution and public education around the vaccine. We were thrilled about a month ago that the president was able to announce that we'll have the supply to vaccinate every American adult by the end of May. And recently, the president announced that by April 19th, we will have the capacity to have vaccine distribution sites within 5 miles of 90% of all Americans. And in addition to that, for some of those folks in kind of, you know, more remote, harder to reach communities, we have additional mobile vaccination clinics and other options in our tool belt that are funded through the American Rescue Plan. And so we're really excited about, you know, what we're seeing so far on vaccinations. You know, we know that, you know, there's still a lot of questions by some. And so we've announced today our COVID community core, which is devoted to ensuring that we're, you know, answering folks' questions. We're using trusted community partners and community messengers. It's a partnership of over 300 organizations that have signed on so far, and looking forward to that. And so we're really grateful to have the opportunity to get that done and to be able to provide some immediate relief to rural communities and make some headway on the vaccination effort as well. And, you know, kind of transitioning into, you know, what the president talked about yesterday, which, you know, the rescue plan was really intended to provide that immediate relief for working families and for communities and also to help support the vaccination effort. But the president has also outlined, and I think we've, you know, again, have seen the needs for real infrastructure funding, you know, and a lot of the needs that have been exacerbated during this pandemic. It's also, you know, for economic recovery and to provide, you know, those resources for rural communities, but also for the manufacturing and business sector to be able to prosper and thrive, especially in rural areas. And so I just wanted to real quick go over some of the pieces that the president outlined in his announcement yesterday of the American Jobs Plan. So the plan has four parts, all of which will affect our everyday lives. The first is how we move, investments in our roads, bridges, rail, and other elements of our transportation infrastructure. The second is how we live at home, investments in broadband, water, power, housing, and buildings. The third is how we care for one another, investments in home and community-based care for older family members and people with disabilities. And the fourth is how we make investments in manufacturing, next generation research and development, high quality workforce development, and critical supply chains. So let's start with how we move and the transportation infrastructure. Ranking 13th in the world in infrastructure has real costs. Delays caused by traffic congestion alone cost over $160 billion per year, and motorists are forced to pay over $1,000 every year in wasted time and fuel. The plan invests $620 billion in our transportation infrastructure. It will modernize 20,000 miles of highways, roads, and main streets in rural communities. It will fix the 10 most economically significant bridges in need of reconstruction and repair the worst 10,000 smaller bridges, reconnecting rural communities and urban communities across the country. It will double federal funding for public transit. It will also spark the electric vehicle revolution, building a network of 500,000 electric vehicle chargers across the country, replacing 50,000 diesel transit vehicles, electrifying at least 20% of our yellow school bus fleet, and helping consumers purchase the vehicles of tomorrow. And it will also make our infrastructure more resilient to climate change, in addition to targeting 40% of the benefits of the climate and clean infrastructure investments to disadvantaged communities. Again, the second part of this plan is about investments in the way that Americans live at home. Right now, too many families live without access to internet at minimally acceptable speeds. Of course, you know, this is a huge problem in rural communities. It's really become a problem of equity as well as a real, you know, economic and financial problem, especially for our manufacturers and small businesses. More than 35% of households in rural areas are left without access to internet that's at minimally acceptable speeds, let alone speeds that allow for us to do the work and learning and everything that we're doing at home during this pandemic. As many as 10 million families live in homes that still receive drinking water through lead service lines and pipes. Too many families live with power outages that cost lives and cost the U.S. economy billions every year. And too many families live in homes that they struggle to afford. And so the plan invests around $650 billion to reconnect communities and transform the way that we live, investing in broadband, clean water, the electric grid, and the building of high-quality, affordable housing. The plan will also deliver universal broadband access, including to the more than 35% of rural Americans who currently lack access, in addition to underserved communities that currently can't afford it. It will replace 100% of the nation's lead pipes and service lines and reduce lead exposure in 400,000 schools and childcare centers. It will lay thousands of miles of transmission lines, making our electric grid more resilient. And it will build and renovate and retrofit more than 2 million homes and housing units. And another additional part of the plan will repair our schools, community colleges, childcare facilities, and federal buildings, including our VA hospitals. The third part of this plan is about investing in how we care for one another. Right now, hundreds of thousands of seniors and people with disabilities who need better care are unable to access it. And one in six essential care workers who are disproportionately women of color and work full-time providing care to our loved ones, our parents and children live in poverty. And the American Jobs Plan invests $400 billion in the care economy. The plan will support well-paying caregiving jobs that include benefits and the ability to collectively bargain. And the plan will also expand access to quality, affordable home or community-based care for hundreds of thousands of seniors and people with disabilities, including by extending the longstanding Money Follows the Person program that supports innovations in the delivery of long-term care. And the fourth part of this plan is investing in how we as Americans create and make and manufacture. We are one of the few major economies whose public investments in research and development has declined as a percentage of GDP in the past 25 years. At the same time, China now ranks number two in the world in R&D expenditures. Over the last 30 years, we have lost over a quarter of our small and medium-sized manufacturing plants. Meanwhile, over half of all high-growth, high-wage jobs are concentrated in only 41 counties in the country. The plan invests around $580 billion in R&D, manufacturing, and training. The plan makes a historic $180 million investment in R&D, the biggest increase in non-defense public R&D spending in history, with a specific focus on high-growth sectors like clean energy. On manufacturing, we will make more of what is discovered here in America by offering new incentives to help companies work with researchers and local leaders to rebuild our supply chains. This plan will make a $50 billion investment in domestic semiconductor manufacturing, securing U.S. leadership in a global market that supplies critical inputs for almost all of our goods, from our cars to our refrigerators to our computers. We will build a more inclusive STEM workforce through focused investments in the more than 30% of students that study at HBCUs and other minority-serving institutions. And the plan will support clean energy manufacturing projects in coal communities and other energy-producing communities, and reinvest in our industrial heartland by providing incentives for companies large and small to locate manufacturing jobs here. And finally, the plan will double the number of registered apprenticeships from where we are today to over 1 million, ensuring that these programs reach workers and students who have typically been left out, because we know how much of an issue workforce can be, especially in rural areas for manufacturing and the business community. And so this plan really invests heavily in the future of our manufacturing sector. And it's so critically important at this time. I think the president said it best yesterday when he talked about this is, you know, he hopes that in achieving this plan, as we work with Congress, as we work with stakeholders like all of you to perfect this plan and ensure that it, you know, does all that it's intended to do, that this could truly be the moment that our country won the future. And I think that's couldn't be truer for in the sense of the investment that that's made here for rural communities. And so I really want to thank you all for this excellent opportunity to talk with you about the American Jobs Plan, to talk to you a little bit about how the president intends to make these investments to ensure that we can, you know, continue to strengthen our manufacturing sector here at home, continue to create new jobs in rural communities and partner with all of you to do that. So thank you again for this opportunity, and I'll kick it back to Liz.
Thanks so much, Will. I know it's a busy time for you and everyone at the White House with yesterday's big announcement, so I really appreciate your time with us today. Our next speaker is Ross DeVall, the president and CEO of Heartland Forward. It's a pleasure to have you with us, Ross. I'll hand it over to you.
Well, thank you very much, Liz, for that kind introduction. And Heartland Forward is pleased to participate in this discussion around opportunities for reshoring manufacturing operations in America, but specifically in the Heartland. And our definition of the Heartland, there are 20 states running from Michigan in the Northeast, South to Alabama, West to Texas, and North to North Dakota. Some might refer to it as the center of the country. Others might use a pejorative term that I won't mention. We appreciate Business Forward's interest in this important topic in organizing this discussion. COVID-19's effect on global supply chains has highlighted many of the challenges posed by offshoring production of American manufacturers over recent decades. While understanding the financial incentives to locate manufacturing operations overseas, many of those cost advantages have diminished in recent years, and other perceived cost advantages were not accurate. Some estimates suggest that firms fail to accurately estimate the cost of production in other countries by as much as 20%. Considering these additional costs, experts suggest that 10 to 30% of projects considering locating production operations outside of the US would find it cheaper to locate those operations or expand within the US. And let's be frank, China is at the center of these discussions on reshoring manufacturing. So reshoring of production activities to the US presents an economic opportunity in our opinion, particularly here in the heartland. Economic development professionals and policymakers can use import substitution and supply chain gap analysis to identify industries where reshoring is appropriate. Our recently released report, Reshoring America, Can the Heartland Lead the Way?, makes the argument that the global pandemic has intensified factors that make US-based production not just competitive, but more profitable than overseas locations. The industrial assets of the heartland are vast, transportation networks, available power and water, coupled with a legacy of hardworking laborers, training facilities, and proximity to suppliers and a large North American consumption market, makes a compelling case for locating production activity in America's middle. However, we have to be honest, not everything can or should be produced in the United States, which begs the question, what industries or products make the most sense to reshore? I think there are several factors. I'll list five of them. One is production costs. Factors affect directly production costs like wages, availability of inputs, energy. Those all still matter, but the weight that these factors play in understanding a firm's costs of production have changed due to trends in automation, new materials, rapidly changing consumer preferences, just among others. For example, as manufacturing wages have risen in China, has the wage gap narrowed sufficiently with the US so that it no longer provides the competitive advantage of the past? Federal policies, as Will just mentioned, are the products under scrutiny prioritized by federal legislation, regulation, or necessity, such as executive orders recently issued by the president calling for increased production of domestic goods and resilient supply chains? Third, available supply. Is the supply of products concentrated in such a way that it leaves US businesses vulnerable to either price manipulation or unnecessary supply shortages? Four, quality. Are existing overseas products inferior or insufficient for US products and applications? Or is the quality of overseas products highly variable? And of course, last, fifth, enforcement rights. Are intellectual property rights compromised or difficult to enforce overseas? Heartland Forward believes that most of these opportunities for reshoring are available in the American heartland. And I can't think of an initiative that has the potential to be more bipartisan in nature than reshoring manufacturing. I appreciate the time and look forward to our discussion. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ross. Our next speaker is Rick Platt. Rick's the CEO of Heath Newark Licking County Port Authority. Thank you for joining us, Rick. We'd love to hear more about your work.
Yeah, thanks, Liz. I'm also in Ohio. That long name we have doesn't necessarily tell you that. Reshoring is imperative. It's a bipartisan issue, as Ross just said. It's clearly one of those issues that who can't agree? Let's bring manufacturing back to the US. Corporate side agrees as well. A recent Bank of America survey found 75% of global corporate respondents saw the need to bring supply chains closer home. The Wall Street Journal agreed with the Heartland Forward's report that recently middle America is the new emerging market. The factors that are behind reshoring: energy, affordability, logistics, a culture of manufacturing, and most of all, a strong workforce are found in the heartland, and in particular, showing my bias right here in Ohio. I'm on this panel as a practitioner. We're working right on the front line of attracting manufacturing investment and growth. Economic development is defined as creating an environment where people are willing to risk capital. And I think that really our Port Authority took over a former Air Force Base facility. And I guess I'd like to suggest that we're a microcosm of the sort of critical industry that this pandemic has showed is so important. We're a place where everything from baby formula to missile guidance systems is manufactured. Defense, metals, energy, food are found on in industry on our campus, again, former Air Force Base. And we've seen a growing trend of plant-based food industry, again, baby formula that's plant-based, and even seafood in the middle of Ohio that's plant-based and found on our campus. And despite this pandemic crisis, we saw a 13% growth in employment on our campus in 2020, with average wages higher than other sectors. I'm bullish on manufacturing. You know, reshoring is going to happen and it's coming to the American heartland. I'm glad that this forum is being presented for a chance to keep this issue alive. It's important for our entire nation, and I think the heartland can answer the call to crisis.
Thank you, Rick, and thank everyone for their opening remarks. And Mayor Whaley, thank you for joining us, and I will hand it over to you.
Well, thank you, Rick and Ross. Certainly appreciate Will being on today, and thanks for your time today to really talk about how important manufacturing and the investment in the Heartland is. We have some questions from business leaders from across the country, and we'd like to start with a pressing question on the process of reshoring manufacturing. Ross, you talked about this, I think, so eloquently. Luis Gonzalez, a business analyst at Farmingdale in Simi Valley, California, asks, what is the plan of this administration to promote U.S.-made manufacturing and the incentives that it will offer? He'd like to know of any opportunities for entrepreneurs. I know Will touched on this in the remarks, but Ross and Rick, would you like to expand on the opportunities you foresee?
Well, thank you for that question, Mayor Whaley. I would say the Trump administration used a lot of sticks to try and incentivize reshoring production in the U.S., such as tariffs. Many of them against China, we can all understand the motivation behind doing so. But the reality is that doesn't fix the problem. It can perhaps alleviate things in the near term. We need a series of carrots as well, various incentives. And in the American Jobs Plan, there is a tax credit to support reshoring that was included. We haven't seen all the details on that, but I certainly think that's an area that needs to be explored more fully. Also, the Biden administration has made government funding of infrastructure projects to be manufactured by domestic producers. Mm-hmm. So that was written in the Defense Act, Production Act. Also, I think we need to think about filling the supply chain gaps that are out there. And quite frankly, I'm not sure it's going to be large incumbents that come to call to the order here. There'll be some. But I think it's newly innovative entrepreneurs that are going to recognize some of these opportunities. And I think we fail to realize sometimes that there's a great deal of entrepreneurship in manufacturing. And there's many small manufacturers out there that can respond very nimbly where large companies can't. And in the American heartland, that has been the backbone of the entire region, are these entrepreneurs that recognize opportunities and are able to seize them. We need to get them a lot of the tools. We need to provide more entrepreneurial support. There needs to be more funding from the federal government in combination with local communities. And I would say through community college is a great place to make that happen. There's just a lot of things that I think can be done. I mean, who would have thought about it? Here's an example of a nimble manufacturer. Craft distilleries in the US and breweries that produced hand sanitizer during COVID-19. They completely switched their operations and were able to do that. So I think there's a lot of things that we need to do. One of them is recognizing that entrepreneurship is a great piece of the solution. We did a study last year that looked at the role that what we call young firms under the age 5 years or less, play in job creation across the country. Metropolitan, micropolitans, and we found that it is the single most important factor for the differences in job growth around the nation, your involvement in entrepreneurship and scaling firms up. So there's a lot to wrap around that. I'll stop there and let Rick add his perspective.
Really, I was nodding my head to a lot of things that Ross was saying. As I said in my opening remarks, reshoring is imperative. I do think, as someone on front lines, I mean, half of the inquiries that we get from companies looking at our sites and buildings are from foreign direct investment companies that even before this crisis, we're looking if they want to be in America to sell in America. But I think what happens is that sometimes our uncertainty at the federal level will send the wrong signal. So I think messaging is important. You know, this framework of the president's plan got announced yesterday. I think embracing bipartisan nature of this issue should be part of that messaging. I think it sends the right signal. Almost, I'll analogize it to the doctors take the Hippocratic oath. I mean, first, do no harm. If our federal policy folks would think that as they go forward, I think we'd all be better off, and it would send the right message to folks looking at the federal level. Let me just add one more thing. It piggybacks Ross's comments. In Ohio, and I think it's illustrative of manufacturing states, 60% of our manufacturers have less than 20 employees. I mean, so really manufacturing is small business. We're not going to be able to reach every one of them, but every one of them could be a microcosm of what really changes things in Ohio. We have a company that started making in Findlay these masks that are kind of a replacement for the N95 masks. Purell in Akron started their expansion four times during the pandemic, but started in Cuyahoga Falls, headquartered in Akron, Ohio. Small companies are the heart of the heartland as well.
Yeah, well said, Rick. I mean, in Dayton too, we see these small manufacturing companies being the key. Although I would say like Gojo and Purell are probably like one of the bigger manufacturers in Ohio right now, which we're super grateful for. Ross, you talked a little bit about entrepreneurship and you touched just a bit on education and reviving manufacturing. Do you want to say a little more about that? We had a question from Greg Fleming, a retired IBM executive, about that in Wilmington, Delaware.
No, it's a great question. I'm going to be transparent about my bias. My father ran vocational education in the state of Ohio for the last 15 years of his career. And, you know, he said to me once, we've made vocational ed a dirty word. It's like, parents, don't let your children grow up to go to a vocational school to go work in dirty manufacturing jobs. That idea is so outmoded. I think that we failed a lot of America's youth by steering them in that direction. Sure, higher education, four-year degree, advanced degrees are great to have, but they're not for everyone. And you can achieve a middle-income, middle-class job by working in manufacturing. So today, I think we need to have more focused programs in career technical education. We would call it instead of vocational education. And we need to reframe the way we conduct career technical education. If you look around the country at smaller communities that have been most successful, and I'll give you a great example, Findlay, Ohio. They were one of the top communities under 50,000 people in our most dynamic micropolitans report that we do on an annual basis. And what's one of their advantages? Well, they have their former community college, Findlay, working with the local business sector, the local large manufacturers, constantly updating their curriculum so that the graduates of those programs have skills that enable them to walk right into a job. And we need to have more apprenticeships. And I would say we need to take career technical education, career pathways back to middle school and high school so that there's a continuous curriculum that allows people to be on that pathway. Maybe it goes on to an associate degree or a certification through an apprenticeship. But to me, that's an area that's just ripe for reinvestment. I think the announcement yesterday addresses some of that, but the action is really going to be the federal government providing the funding and support, but it's going to be up to local actors, employers, mayors, community colleges, and the entire infrastructure of the community to get engaged in, first of all, recognizing that career technical education provides a good paying job, and it is something that's essential to restore American manufacturing.
Great. Rick, do you have anything to add to that? I think
we're yeah, really.
In your head when Ross was talking
about that. I don't have a poker face. Totally agreeing with what Ross said about career schools and what they can bring to our economy. It is. I mean, all development is local. That's a phrase that I use all the time. And really, career schools are not only educating high school age, but they're also doing adult training in many communities. In Ohio, we see it in particular in a community I'm in, Licking County, our career school has done a model pre-employment training program that ramped up in the middle of pandemic to help folks find a different career path so that when they saw that they weren't going back to the job they were in before, they could get into a job in manufacturing with a manufacturing credential that they could bring from day one. That it's important that our local communities be able to keep standing up those capabilities.
Thanks, Rick. Aaron Slotov, the owner of Atomic Industries in Cleveland, actually asked, can we find funding for startups that are pushing the envelope on developing new manufacturing technologies to help the U.S. redevelop its own supply chain? Rick, do you have any thoughts about that?
I'd certainly like to help Aaron connect the dots up in Northeast Ohio. Lots of opportunities for that. And Jobs Ohio, our state's economic development engine, is able to do some of those type of things, or certainly connect up in the network with other opportunities. So just again, as we said, entrepreneurs are the heart of manufacturing.
Agreed. Ross?
Yeah, Mary Whaley, I'd like to add just a little bit to that, maybe more of a from a broader perspective, looking at some programs the federal government already has in place or programs that could be enhanced. So under the Small Business Administration's credit programs, they have something that's called Section 7A, where the SBA guarantees loans originated by banks and other financial institutions. Currently, the program supports about $23 billion in these loans, but I think we could reconfigure and expand that program that would assist younger firms. So currently, I think there's a bias in that it principally focuses on the size of the organization, the firm, rather than its age. So this leaves out a lot of younger entrepreneurs that are trying to get started in the space that are not eligible because of that. And so we need to focus more on those younger aspiring entrepreneurs, and federal policymakers need to look at establishing a federal loan guarantee program, I think, is kind of a carve out for this. I mean, also, I think if you look at minority entrepreneurs, they are greatly underfunded. They have such challenges in access to capital, and minority owned depository institutions could help fill that gap. I know you had another question around that, so I'll save my response to that, but I think that's a big piece of it. And also, I think contained in the American Jobs Plan, there's discussions around a small business opportunity fund to help state and local venture capital programs that might provide up to, I think there's $10 billion in the program, but through credit enhancements, it could even be $50 billion. So it's really hard to get access to early stage risk capital. Many people talk about venture capital. Venture capitalists are not likely to fund too many things in the early stages in the manufacturing sector. They do, that's an exaggeration, but I think we need to be frank and make sure that we get early stage risk capital into those younger entrepreneurs or entrepreneurs of any age in younger firms, because those are the companies that scale up, create jobs, and are going to be our future employers.
Well, let's talk a bit about minority and women-owned businesses now, as you mentioned. We heard from Duellen Bodoin McKee, a business leader in Bogalusa, Louisiana. She's making thermoregulated emergency supply containers. And so she's asking about how reshoring manufacturing jobs benefit her and other minority and women-owned businesses, which I think you were touching on a little bit, Ross.
Yeah, I was. Let me continue a little bit there. So, I mean, COVID-19 has demonstrated a lot of the inequities in America. We knew they existed, but they've come to the forefront. So one example is Black entrepreneurs have the lowest rate of startups in the country amongst any demographic group. And a lot of this has to do with an inability to access capital, especially at banks. Not many banks are going to make an investment, making a loan based upon the intellectual property, your idea, if you don't have hard assets. And many minority and even women entrepreneurs don't have those hard assets they can put up as collateral for a loan. And this is a real challenge in getting access to that capital. So I think a lot of these programs I just discussed, the minority depository-owned institutions, I think could play a big role here. And this was one of the challenges with the PPP protection program. When those funds were allocated, very few of them, at least in the first round, a few more in the second round, went to minority-owned depository institutions. And so guess what? Minority entrepreneurs didn't get many of those funds. And they've been really suffering trying to make ends meet. I think there's a lot more we need to do around women and minority entrepreneurs in terms of getting them the skills and training that they require, especially for their employees or ones that could become their employees. And I'm going to say something here that's outside of normal economic discussions, and I'm a trained economist, which is we need to also think about childcare as part of the retraining process for many women who are either transitioning into a different career or for whatever reason, they have young children at home, they can't enroll in a certification or apprenticeship program, they need help with daycare. And so I think we need a more holistic approach in looking about how we support women and minority entrepreneurs. Access to capital is a big part of that, but training and mentoring, a big component as well.
Very well said. And I'm glad you mentioned the child care piece, which is just such a key issue for the women workforce that we've seen really be a huge issue during the COVID pandemic, right? So that lands more on women than men. We're running out a little bit of time, but I do want to talk a bit about jobs, something that we love to talk about in the heartland nonstop, and put these two questions together for you all. And Rick, I'm going to ask you to talk about them first. The first is from Aaron McPike, Test Strategies in Washington, D.C. Can you describe the degree to which the kinds of manufacturing jobs you're aiming for our next generation and how they might evolve as the constant need to upskill workers changes in the landscape? And then Johnny Thomas from Milwaukee would like to know what programs are available for veterans to capitalize on manufacturing and construction, et cetera.
That second one first, I mean, I know so many of our companies on our campus here, and I think there are examples around the country that they crave the veterans as prospective employees. And really it comes down to grassroots. Anything that be done to help connect the dots for veterans to jobs that would be something that's good for all of our economies. The first one, what comes to mind is that it's really a misnomer, I think, that manufacturing isn't advanced. I've been doing this for a long time. I've earned this gray hair. And 25 years ago, I was summoned to go visit with a company in Berkles, Ohio. You could Google that if you want to. And there was a lumber company there. And I thought, wow, stereotypically, I was going to find some really rough place. It was the first time I saw voice recognition software used in manufacturing. And that was 25 years ago. They were ahead of their time. Really, there is no manufacturing that isn't advanced that has survived in this country. And I think the kind of reshoring that we're going to see is going to be the same. So, you know, next generation, sure, we all need to make sure that we're competing and able to stay up on the next generation. But I think manufacturers are up to that because they're already doing it.
Ross?
Yes, Mayor. I think we need to have a frank conversation around where the opportunities reside for reshoring manufacturing in America. Because 10 years ago, we had these discussions and I don't think they were realistic. And what I mean by that is it's going to principally be high value added industries that are capital intensive that are going to either come back to the United States or expand further. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't supply chain gaps where it may not be high tech, where you can fill it through an entrepreneur who recognizes an opportunity. And we have to recognize that these global supply chains are not as secure as we thought they were. That's clearly what COVID-19 demonstrated. I mean, look at the heartland today, especially in Ohio. Who would have thought we'd have a computer chip shortage, which causes to shut down auto production facilities. So that is going on. So I think we need to understand it's going to be capital intensive, advanced manufacturing sectors. And what's going to be a critical component of that is what I touched upon earlier, which is the retraining and upskilling, the career technical education, having those latest updated skills, because if we're going to capture those industries, that's where it's going to happen. And another factor I don't believe that people fully understand when they think about manufacturing. Manufacturing has a high multiplier or ripple effect on the rest of the economy. Now, I'm an economist, so I use that term. What does that mean? What it means is each job in manufacturing can support 3 to 4, up to 5 jobs in other industries. So think of professional services, accounting, legal, advertising, a whole range of those sectors. So even though you might be looking at capital intensive advanced manufacturing industries having the greatest potential for reshoring and expansion here, and they may not be as large of an employer due to automation, but they are going to be providing job creation opportunities in the service sector, professional business services, a wide variety. So we need to think more broadly about manufacturing. Number one, it's not those old dirty shop floor jobs you think about. There's people using laser-guided machine tools for cutting, for capital goods. It's all these things that we've discussed. So I would just say, think about it more holistically, and it's the workforce training that could provide us with a greater advantage Germany does a great job in retraining and manufacturing, and we need to take something from their playbook and apply it here domestically.
Yeah, I know a lot of mayors have gone to Germany to really look at their apprentice training and their retraining because it is so terrific. We're running out of time, but I do want to ask an important question. It might just be because I'm in Dayton and we do a lot of auto manufacturing and it's on our mind. But as moderator, I'm allowed to ask the questions I like a lot. And this one, it comes from Russ Carnahan of Carnahan Global Consulting in St. Louis, Missouri. As we're really talking about this move on climate change and the opportunity for this to really create jobs and, you know, how that happens, I think is really key. He says the heartland, including his home state of Missouri, much like Ohio, is also known for auto and related industries. How do you see the public and private sector engaging in the transition to EVs and the infrastructure and the major competition in this sector from China for EVs, batteries, and raw materials? How do you see this happening? As I'm thinking of this along the I-75 corridor, Rick, what are your thoughts?
Well, we're seeing it so many different ways in Ohio. You know, I don't have a crystal ball to say electric vehicles are when they're going to move forward faster than not. Certainly, there's a lot of movement that way. But in Youngstown, they're calling themselves the Voltage Valley, seeing a lot of investment in batteries and, of course, a new electric vehicle from the truck side of the market potentially emerging. And that's a community in Northeast Ohio that's had a long history in the automotive industry of all sides. Of course, the I-75 corridor, as you mentioned, Mayor Whaley. But there's more to that. I mean, in Ohio, we've seen SpaceX materials coming to small testing labs in Ohio, creating a significant amount of work. So I guess what I'm saying is there's a supply chain that more than meets the eye. The headlines are made by the big investments that have been announced, but the real impact's coming from some of the smaller things that are already happening in that side of the automotive sector in all of the heartland, and I've seen it mostly in Ohio.
Ross, what do you think about this transition that we're starting to see?
Yeah, let me take a bit bigger picture. China has a command and control economy. There are disadvantages and advantages of having that. In the case of EVs, batteries, rare earth materials, that does provide a real advantage because they can marshal the resources and get everyone moving in the same direction. And they have made tremendous advancements in the EV space. I personally believe that we need an industry government consortium in the United States to address this in a kind of a pre-competitive space. The Obama administration worked on this, but I think more progress needs to be made. So one, I think we need to look at bringing the R&D incentive nature together with those manufacturers that are already moving in this direction, providing them support. And it's going to require firms collaborating in kind of a pre-competitive space for us to get the critical mass to, I think, really be able to compete against China, because we are really, in many respects, behind them, and we can fix that.
I think that's a really good point, and I hope folks are listening. And I mean, I think that really is something that's really key for us in the next, you know, 4 to 5 years here. So there were so many more questions by folks, so we get really deep into it. And I know I would have liked to talk a little more about trade policy and how that affects the heartland. Liz will just have to have us on, guys, another time to have that discussion. Rick, always good to see you. Thank you for your amazing leadership in Ohio, particularly during the pandemic. And Ross, it was really great to hear your advocacy for something that's near and dear to my heart, the heartland of manufacturing. So with that, Liz, I'll turn it back over to you.
Thank you, Mayor Whaley, Ross, Will, and Rick for such a robust discussion today. And before we go, I just have one last question from the network. We've had a few business leaders ask for ways they can support the proposals or the solutions you all have been discussing today. And I think we'll open up to Mayor Whaley. Do you have any recommendations for how they should get involved?
Well, first, I think in the region for us, like an example is we have the Dayton Manufacturing Task Force to really work on our supply chain work and support manufacturers and small businesses across our community. So think about that for your own community. I'm hoping that Ross, since he has a more broader view, has some good recommendations. Rick, I don't know if you have anything to recommend.
Well, to me, the strength in numbers. So it really team up on the local level with others that share your, I think workforce is the best example. That's one of we have a demographic challenge of the baby boomers that retired that all of the country is suffering from, and the Heartland's not exempt from that. We need to communicate that companies are hiring, and then communicate the skills that are needed in order to get hired and entry level at our manufacturers. I think that can be done collectively and at the local level.
Well, let me just say, Mayor Whaley, Heartland Forward's website has some of these organizations that are heavily involved in the space. If you go to it, you'll find some of it there. And to be quite frank, it requires engagement with your representatives, both in your home state and in Washington, because we need to make this a bipartisan issue to be fully addressed. It can't just change focus from one administration to the next. It needs to be part of a continuum. And industry has the most powerful voice in state capitals and in the nation's capital. So I would say, make sure your representatives are aware this is an important issue to them and they need to pay attention.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you all so much for joining us. Thank you so much to Mayor Whaley, Ross, Will, Rick, and everyone who joined today's briefing. We look forward to seeing you again soon.
Thank you everyone for joining us. For more information on Business Forward programming, visit businessfwd.org. The Business Forward podcast is a production of Business Forward, hosted by me, Jim Doyle. Produced and engineered by Alexi Lippman and Alex Pastanen. Special thanks to Jana Platt. Thanks for listening. See you next time.